This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Lieutenant John Fanning had no business interfering with the jury in the first Karen Reed trial. But somehow, on the final day of deliberations, he became the catalyst for one of the most questionable removals of a juror in recent history. Do you know about this? A single decision, based on flimsy, if not outright or non-existent evidence, allegedly, changed the course of the trial. And now, as Reed's defense team gears up for a retrial, they aren't letting this one slide. They're making the case that Fanning, a high-ranking Massachusetts state police officer, manipulated the jury process, potentially at the direction of prosecutors, in a move that could amount to obstruction of justice. I know, big story here. Here's what happened. Fanning wasn't just any cop in the background of the Reed case. He had access to key parts of the legal process that most officers wouldn't. While he wasn't on the witness stand, he was embedded within the courthouse, in contact with court officers, and positioned in a way that gave him unique access to the jury. It's not speculation, that's fact. He had a hand in overseeing the jury's security, a role that, on paper, should be nothing more than a logistical assignment. But somehow, on the final day of deliberations, he inserted himself into one of the most critical decisions of the entire case: the removal of juror number three. Juror number three was dismissed just as deliberations were reaching a crucial point. It was Fanning who claimed that the juror had been caught talking about the case at a bar weeks before deliberations began. It's a serious allegation, one that, if true, would justify removal. But there's a problem. Fanning says there was video proof of this misconduct. That video, to this day, has never been produced. There's a video, guys! It's on video! Normally, you would go take a look at that and go, okay, can you prove this? Or are you just saying this? Or you heard this from someone? It didn't show up in the courtroom. It wasn't submitted as evidence, and no one, including the judge, has ever seen it. And yet, based solely on Fanning's word, the juror was removed. Even more concerning, the juror was allegedly leaning towards acquitting Reed. Let's pause for a moment and consider how absurd this all is. A cop with a vetted interest in the outcome of the case, one who was in direct contact with the same law enforcement officials who built that case, suddenly claims to have evidence of jury misconduct. But he never provides it. No affidavit, no testimony under oath, just his word. We'll learn more about his word in just a little bit, because it's not just this case that he's been involved in that has had questionable actions. And that's all it took for the judge to remove the juror. That was it. His word. If this happened in a high-profile corporate trial, or say, the case of a mob boss, people would be screaming about corruption. But here, in a case where the defendant is accusing law enforcement of framing her, a juror who might have stood in the way of a conviction was removed. And we're just supposed to accept it as normal. Nothing to see here. Nothing there. It's all good. He's well respected. Is he? Is he? We'll talk more about the background of Mr. Fanning in just a bit and let you make your own judgments. The defense sure isn't buying it. In the lead up to the retrial, Reed's attorneys are arguing that this wasn't just an unfortunate misunderstanding or a lapse in the courtroom procedure. They say this was deliberate, that Fanning knowingly provided a misleading or false report about the juror, and that it was done to sway the case in favor of the prosecution. If they're right, that's not just courtroom gamesmanship. That's obstruction. That's jury tampering. It's a serious crime. Same sort of thing we saw over in the Alec Murtaugh case. And here's why this matters. No matter what side of the road you are on in the Karen Reed case, I am bringing you the story from the middle. The jury is supposed to be the one part of the system that remains untouchable. Prosecutors build their case, defense attorneys counter it, and then a panel of citizens decides the outcome. That's the deal. But if someone in law enforcement, especially someone with Fanning's level of influence, can just step in and remove a juror without providing hard evidence, then what's stopping them from doing it in any other case? What's stopping them from deciding behind closed doors who gets a fair trial and who doesn't? The system only works if jurors are chosen fairly and allowed to do their job without interference. If that process can be manipulated, then the entire trial is compromised. Now, the prosecution, of course, is defending the decision. They're arguing that Fanning is a respected officer with years of experience and that his report about the juror should be taken at face value. It's like the face value of Sandra Birchmore. Yes, of course, it was a suicide. And we'll get to that part again in just a little bit, because he's involved over there, too. Surprise. They claim that even though the video was never provided, the claim itself was serious enough to warrant the juror's removal. But let's be real. Just trust us isn't an argument that holds up in a court of law. If a defense attorney tried to have a juror removed based on hearsay with zero supporting evidence, they'd be laughed out of the courtroom. But when it's a cop making the claim, then it's suddenly enough. Because there's never crooked cops. That's not how justice is supposed to work. The implications of this go far beyond Karen Reed. If law enforcement can quietly influence jury selection, whether by removing a single juror or shaping the overall panel, then how many other cases have been decided this way? How many other people have been convicted or acquitted, not based on evidence, but because someone with the right connections made sure the wrong juror wasn't in the room when it mattered? These aren't just hypothetical concerns. If Fanning's report about juror number 3 was knowingly false, then that means a cop had the power to alter the outcome of a high-profile trial based on nothing more than his word. And that should scare anyone who believes in the idea of a fair trial. And Mr. Fanning, if you have this video evidence, please bring it out. I'll be happy to be wrong. Everyone will. We just want this to be a fair trial. And it's looking like it might not have been. You say you got this evidence. Let's see it. If during the trial itself, someone just says, believe me, take me at my word, of a major piece of it, and there's no evidence to back up that statement, and there's a vested interest in that person to see things go a certain way, it's not going to be evidence. You have to prove your claims. The defense is now pushing for an inquiry into this, and if they can prove that Fanning's report was inaccurate or worse, intentional, it could have major consequences. If a retrial moves forward, expect this to be one of the most explosive issues at play, because if one juror was removed under suspicious circumstances, it raises the question, what else happened behind the scenes that we do not know about? And that's where the story takes a turn, because as troubling as Fanning's role is in the jury removal process, it's not the only reason his involvement in this case is raising eyebrows. The deeper you look, the more you start to see a pattern. One that goes beyond just this trial and raises even bigger questions about how law enforcement handled this case and others from the start. Let's go over to Trooper Michael Proctor for a moment. He was supposed to be investigating a death. Instead, he was cracking jokes in a group chat about the woman he was charging with murder. Kind of a big deal when you're charging someone with murder. What's he doing on his phone on the side? Texting about Karen Reid? No nudes so far, he texted after searching Karen Reid's phone. A remark that wasn't just wildly unprofessional exposed a predetermined bias that ran through the entire investigation. This wasn't law enforcement meticulously piecing together the facts of the case. This was a lead investigator treating a homicide suspect like a punchline. And the worst part? His supervisor, Lieutenant John Fanning, was right there in the conversation. And he did nothing. Good old boys, right? Always trust him. The texts weren't some minor lapse in judgment. They revealed a pattern. An entire investigative unit more interested in ridiculing Reid or finding nudes than in actually solving the death of John O'Keefe. The messages ranged from crude remarks to clear indications that Proctor had already made up his mind about Reid's guilt, before all the evidence was even in, that alone should have raised alarm. But it wasn't until these messages were exposed, long after Reid had been charged, that the public got a glimpse of just how deep the bias ran. The moment those texts became public, the prosecution had a problem. This is no longer just a case of whether Reid was guilty or innocent. It was about whether the investigation itself had been poisoned from the start. If the lead investigator was already convinced of her guilt before examining all the evidence, what were the chances that he actually followed the facts rather than fitting them to the narrative that had already been decided on by him? Worse, if he was willing to mock the suspect in a text chain with fellow officers, how could anyone believe that the investigation was conducted with fairness, impartiality, or integrity? This is where Lieutenant Fanning comes in. As Proctor's supervisor, he had the power and the responsibility to step in and shut this down. But he didn't. He later claimed that he was on vacation when the messages were sent and wasn't even aware of them until they surfaced in court proceedings. That explanation, while convenient, doesn't change the fact that these messages were exchanged in a group chat that included him. Whether he read them immediately or not, the fact remains that this level of misconduct was happening under his command, and he did absolutely nothing to correct it. An internal affairs investigation was eventually launched to determine whether Fanning had failed in his supervisory role. The conclusion? Unfounded. According to the department, there was insufficient evidence to prove that Fanning had knowingly ignored Proctor's behavior. But let's be clear about what that really means. It doesn't mean he was innocent. It means they couldn't prove what he knew and when he knew it. That's a distinction worth paying attention to. For Reid's defense, this was a gift. If they could show that the officer leading the investigation was biased against Reid, and that his own supervisor had allowed it to continue unchecked, then the entire case could be called into question. Because if the investigator who built the case was compromised, then so was everything that followed. The charges, the evidence, the trial itself. The prosecution, of course, has pushed back. They argue that Proctor's comments were inappropriate, but ultimately had no impact on the investigation's integrity. They claim that Reid was charged based on solid evidence, not because of Proctor's personal opinions. But that argument ignores the reality of how law enforcement works. When the person leading an investigation is biased, that bias trickles down into everything. What evidence gets prioritized, what gets ignored, and what gets interpreted as suspicious and what gets dismissed. And in this case, Proctor's bias was not subtle. He wasn't just investigating Reid, he was mocking her. Then there's the issue of disclosure. These texts weren't immediately handed over to the defense. They only surfaced much later, after Reid had already been charged. That raises another question. What else was kept from the defense? If Proctor's attitude toward Reid was dismissive in private, What are the chances that his case files, his reports, his interviews weren't influenced by that same bias? It's exactly why Reed's defense team is now using these revelations as a foundation of a new argument that the entire case was compromised from the start. That Proctor's bias, combined with Fanning's failure to act, created an investigation that wasn't about finding out what really happened to John O'Keefe, but about making sure the evidence pointed in one direction. And if that's true, then Reed wasn't just being investigated, she was being set up. This is what makes the retrial so significant. The defense isn't just arguing that Reed is innocent. They're arguing that the case against her was never legitimate to begin with. They can prove that the investigation was tainted, that Proctor was biased, and that Fanning ignored it. And they're not just fighting for Reed's acquittal. They're fighting to expose a system that lets this happen in the first place. And this isn't the first time Fanning has been accused of looking the other way. In fact, if you start digging even further into his past cases, you'll notice a troubling pattern. A pattern. And that's important. One that goes beyond just biases and into something much more alarming. And I should say, Fanning has never been charged with anything. He is innocent. I can't even say until proven guilty, again, because there's been no charges against him. These are allegations that have come out. Some of the pieces in this are very factual and can easily be proven. When you put it all together and you look at the big stew of what we have here, a reasonable person may go, this seems a bit off. This seems like a pattern of behavior, a pattern of covering for law enforcement, no matter what. Protecting the blue. Sandra Birchmore was 23, pregnant, and dead in her apartment when police arrived in February of 21. A tragic loss, but according to Lieutenant John Fanning and the investigators under his watch, the case was open and shut. Suicide. Now, we all know what really happened here. It wasn't suicide. No real suspicion, no serious questions asked. Within hours of finding the body of Sandra Birchmore, the narrative was set. A troubled young woman had taken her own life, and there was nothing more to see. Move on, everyone. Except there was. And the facts that emerged in the years that followed made one thing disturbingly clear. This was never just a simple suicide. It was a homicide, one that Fanning and his team had every reason to recognize, but somehow didn't. Or maybe they just didn't want to. At the center of the case was Matthew Farwell, a former Stoughton police detective, with a well-documented history with Birchmore. Their relationship, later revealed through phone records and messages, had started when she was just a teenager. 13, 14 years old. An inappropriate, predatory connection between an officer and a vulnerable girl that continued for years. By the time of her death, she was pregnant with his child. That alone should have raised immediate red flags for investigators, but under Fanning's leadership, the case was treated as an unfortunate tragedy rather than a potential crime scene because, you know, an officer was involved. Can't have that. Despite clear indications that Birchmore had been in a coercive relationship with Farwell, one that had started when she was a minor, and in the Police Explorers program, mind you, police brushed past the implications. The initial investigation overseen by Fanning focused more on Birchmore's personal life than on the circumstances of her death. Witness statements from those close to her, which painted a picture of a woman who was planning for her future, were ignored. Instead, investigators zeroed in on a story of despair, one that fit neatly into the no foul play box. Then there was the forensic evidence, or lack thereof. Under Fanning's direction, the scene wasn't examined with the same rigor that a suspected homicide would warrant. Because if you don't have the evidence, you don't have the evidence. And the evidence is only there for so long, and if it all gets cleaned up and there's nothing more to look at, if it looks at later, well, that sucks. Critical forensic testing that could have determined whether she had actually taken her own life or been strangled was either not performed or not prioritized. The presence of Farwell, a police officer, as the last known person to have significant contact with her, should have determined or demanded scrutiny. Instead, it was even barely acknowledged. One could say brushed under the rug. The Norfolk County District Attorney's Office, the same office that's now prosecuting Karen Reed, rubber-stamped the investigation, closing the case as a suicide without question. That should have been the end of it, right? But in 2024, after a federal investigator stepped in, gotta take the feds to come and, you know, do the big boy stuff, everything changed. It turned out the same case Fanning and the Norfolk DA had confidently closed was in reality a murder. Federal authorities found evidence that Birchmore hadn't simply died by suicide. She had been strangled. They arrested Farwell and charged him with homicide, effectively dismantling Fanning's original conclusion, blowing it up. And just like that, the investigation that had been signed off as conclusive was exposed as a sham. It wasn't just an embarrassing mistake. It was a catastrophic failure that had let a murderer walk free for years. A murderer who also wore the badge. Blue. Can't do anything wrong, right? The feds uncovered what state investigators either missed or deliberately ignored. The difference between those two possibilities is everything. One is incompetence, which could very well be at play. All these people may very well be incompetent. They don't seem like the brightest bulbs. They just don't. The other is corruption. And once again, the pattern emerges. An investigation led by Fanning, where a police officer is implicated, and yet somehow the focus turns away from the officer and towards a more convenient explanation. For Karen Reed's defense, the revelation is more than just another example of police mishandling a case. It's evidence of a pattern of behavior. The Reed case and the Birchmore cases are separated by years, different circumstances, different victims, but the common thread is Fanning. In both, officers with connections to law enforcement were at the center of the incident. And in both, the investigation quickly dismissed any scenario that implicated a police officer. Pushing forward, an alternative explanation that placed blame elsewhere or in Birchmore's case erased the crime altogether. It's a pattern that suggests something beyond mere oversight. If Fanning was capable of leading an investigation that ignored key evidence in Birchmore's case, how can anyone trust that he handled the Reed case properly? Maybe he did. But there's reason, certainly, to have some doubts. If he's willing to accept a rushed, incomplete story in one homicide, why wouldn't he do the same in another? And if the defense can successfully argue that this isn't just a coincidence, that it's part of a systematic problem within the same law enforcement circle that charged Reed, then it could unravel the state's case altogether. The prosecution predictably will fight to keep Birchmore's case out of the Reed trial. They'll argue that it's irrelevant, that what happened in one investigation has nothing to do with another. They'll try to limit what the jury hears to keep them focused only on the details of O'Keefe's death. But the defense knows that if jurors see the Birchmore investigation for what it was, a deliberate refusal to scrutinize a police officer's role in a woman's death, it'll make them question everything about how Reed was prosecuted. Because if the same investigators who failed Birchmore were the ones handling Reed's case, then how much more of their work can be trusted? What evidence was ignored? What alternative theories were dismissed without serious inquiry? What other possibilities were erased because they didn't fit the story prosecutors wanted to tell? Sandra Birchmore's case is a chilling example of what happens when law enforcement investigates its own. Mainly they don't. It's also proof that the people responsible for building the case against Karen Reed have a history of getting things very, very wrong. And not just wrong in the sense of making a mistake. That does happen. They are human. Wrong in the sense of choosing a version of events that lets a police officer off the hook, while someone else, someone without the same connections, takes the fall. That's what makes the retrial so much more than just another chance to argue Reed's innocence. It's about exposing the system that made this happen in the first place. The defense isn't just trying to prove that Reed didn't kill John O'Keefe. They're trying to show that she never stood a chance against an investigation that already decided its conclusion before it even began. And if Fanning's history tells us anything, it's that when police officers are involved, there seems to be a habit of looking the other way. At least, that's what it appears on the surface, allegedly. This shouldn't influence your opinion one way or the other if Karen hit John O'Keefe. I don't think we're ever going to truly know the answer to that. And this is not an argument about him getting beat up in the house and drug out to the end of the curb. I personally don't buy that one at all. It's about having a fair trial. It's about real, solid evidence getting to the forefront and jurors being able to hear it. Because if we can't do that, we have a problem. And if you have the power to remove a juror that you suspect allegedly might be not voting the way you want, that's also a pretty big problem. Especially when you can't produce the evidence of the claim you're trying to bring to the table. Fanning is now the latest hiccup in the case against Karen Reed. What else are we going to find out? Where is this going to go? And how long and how far back does this alleged pattern of corruption go? How many other cases that we're not even paying attention to were affected by this good old boys club, allegedly? That's a question I think we will find the answers to, if in fact that's what's going on. So we have to ask questions. So we have to dig and find out what the hell is going on here. Because his actions alone in the Sandra Birchmore case raise so many questions. Then you mix in Karen Reed, and especially juror number 3. You're kind of left without words. What happened? Will we ever know? And will justice ever come for John O'Keefe?
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. She was a doting mother. The kind who baked cookies, made the best homemade Halloween costumes, and never missed a PTA meeting. The perfect mom. Until the police found something buried in the backyard. A secret she kept for years. A secret she thought would never come to light. The neighbors gasped. Not her. She's so nice. But people forget. Monsters don't always look like monsters. Some wear aprons. Some tuck their kids in at night. And some hide their darkest deeds in places they think no one will ever look. If only someone had heard the warning signs, had recognized the patterns from an eerily similar case on Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If they had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened ad-free before anyone else and saved themselves from baking cookies with a serial killer. Instead, well, they won't be RSVP'ing to this year's PTA meeting. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.